Prologue. The Mono Myth. 1. Myth and Dream. Whether we listen with aloof amusement to the dreamlike mumbo-jumbo of some red-eyed witch doctor of the Congo, or read with cultivated rapture thin translations from the sonnets of the mystic Lao Tzu, now and again crack the hard nut shell of an argument of Aquinas, or catch suddenly the shining meaning of a bizarre Eskimo fairy tale, it will always be the one shape-shifting yet marvelously constant story that we find, together with a challengingly persistent suggestion of more remaining to be experienced than will ever be known or told. Throughout the inhabited world, in all times and under every circumstance, myths of man have flourished, and they have been the living inspiration of whatever else may have appeared out of the activities of the human body and mind. It would not be too much to say that myth is the secret opening through which the inexhaustible energies of the cosmos pour into the human cultural manifestation. Religions, philosophies, arts, the social forms of primitive and historic man, prime discoveries in science and technology, the very dreams that blister sleep, boil up from the basic magic ring of myth. The wonder is that characteristic efficacy to touch and inspire deep creative centers dwells in the smallest nursery fairy tale, as the flavor of the ocean is contained in a droplet, or the whole mystery of life within the egg of a flea. For the symbols of mythology are not manufactured. They cannot be ordered, invented, or permanently suppressed. They are spontaneous productions of the psyche, and each bears within it, undamaged, the germ power of its source. What is the secret of the timeless vision? From what profundity of the mind does it derive? Why is mythology everywhere the same, beneath its varieties of costume? And what does it teach? Today, many scientists are contributing to the analysis of the riddle. Archaeologists are probing the ruins of Iraq, Honan, Crete, and Yucatan. Ethnologists are questioning the Ostiaks of the River Ob, the boobies of Fernando Po. A generation of Orientalists has recently thrown open to us the sacred writings of the East, as well as the pre-Hebrew sources of our own Holy Writ. And meanwhile, another host of scholars, pressing researches begun last century in the field of folk psychology, has been seeking to establish the psychological bases of language, myth, religion, art development, and moral codes. Most remarkable of all, however, are the revelations that have emerged from the mental clinic. The bold and truly epoch-making writings of the psychoanalysts are indispensable to the student of mythology, for whatever may be thought of the detailed and sometimes contradictory interpretations of specific cases and problems, Freud, Jung, and their followers have demonstrated irrefutably that the logic, the heroes, and the deeds of myth survive into modern times. In the absence of an effective general mythology, each of us has his private, unrecognized, rudimentary, yet secretly potent pantheon of dream. The latest incarnation of Oedipus, the continued romance of Beauty and the Beast, stand this afternoon on the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue, waiting for the traffic light to change. "I dreamed," wrote an American youth to the author of a syndicated newspaper feature.
"I dreamed that I was reshingling our roof. Suddenly I heard my father's voice on the ground below calling to me. I turned suddenly to hear him better, and as I did so, the hammer slipped out of my hands and slid down the sloping roof and disappeared over the edge. I heard a heavy thud, as of a body falling. Terribly frightened, I climbed down the ladder to the ground. There was my father, lying dead on the ground, with blood all over his head. I was broken-hearted and began calling my mother in the midst of my sobs. She came out of the house and put her arms around me. "Never mind, son. It was all an accident," she said. "I know you will take care of me even if he is gone." As she was kissing me, I woke up. I am the eldest child in our family and am 23 years old. I have been separated from my wife for a year. Somehow, we could not get along together. I love both my parents dearly and have never had any trouble with my father, except that he insisted that I go back and live with my wife, and I couldn't be happy with her, and I never will.
The unsuccessful husband here reveals, with a really wonderful innocence, that instead of bringing his spiritual energies forward to the love and problems of his marriage, he has been resting in the secret recesses of his imagination. With the now ridiculously anachronistic dramatic situation of his first and only emotional involvement, that of the tragicomic triangle of the nursery, the son against the father for the love of the mother. Apparently, the most permanent of the dispositions of the human psyche are those that derive from the fact that, of all animals, we remain the longest at the mother breast. Human beings are born too soon. They are unfinished, unready as yet to meet the world. Consequently, their whole defense from a universe of dangers is the mother, under whose protection the intrauterine period is prolonged. Hence, the dependent child and its mother constitute for months after the catastrophe of birth a dual unit, not only physically, but also psychologically. Any prolonged absence of the parent causes tension in the infant and consequent impulses of aggression. Also, when the mother is obliged to hamper the child, aggressive responses are aroused. Thus, the first object of the child's hostility is identical with the first object of its love, and its first ideal, which thereafter is retained as the unconscious basis of all images of bliss, truth, beauty, and perfection, is that of the dual unity of the Madonna and Bambino. The unfortunate father is the first radical intrusion of another order of reality into the beatitude of this earthly restatement of the excellence of the situation within the womb. He, therefore, is experienced primarily as an enemy. To him is transferred the charge of aggression that was originally attached to the bad or absent mother, while the desire attaching to the good or present, nourishing and protecting mother, she herself normally retains. This fateful infantile distribution of death, thanatos distrudo, and love, eros, libido, impulses, builds the foundation of the now celebrated Oedipus complex, which Sigmund Freud pointed out some 50 years ago as the great cause of our adult failure to behave like rational beings. As Dr. Freud has stated it, King Oedipus, who slew his father Laius and married his mother Jocasta, merely shows us the fulfillment of our own childhood wishes. But more fortunate than he, we have meanwhile succeeded, insofar as we have not become psychoneurotics, in detaching our sexual impulses from our mothers and in forgetting our jealousy of our fathers. Or, as he writes again, every pathological disorder of sexual life is rightly to be regarded as an inhibition in development.
For many a man hath seen himself in dreams his mother's mate, but he who gives no heed to such like matters bears the easier fate. Sophocles, Oedipus Tyrannus.
It has been pointed out that the father also can be experienced as a protector, and the mother then as a temptress. This is the way from Oedipus to Hamlet. O God, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space, were it not that I have bad dreams. Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2. All neurotics, writes Dr. Freud, are either Oedipus or Hamlet. And as for the case of the daughter, which is one degree more complicated, the following passage will suffice for the present thumbnail exposition. I dreamed last night that my father stabbed my mother in the heart. She died. I knew no one blamed him for what he did, although I was crying bitterly. The dream seemed to change, and he and I seemed to be going on a trip together, and I was very happy. This is the dream of an unmarried young woman of 24.
The sorry plight of the wife of the lover, whose sentiments, instead of maturing, remain locked in the romance of the nursery, may be judged from the apparent nonsense of another modern dream. And here we begin to feel, indeed, that we are entering the realm of ancient myth, but with a curious turn. I dreamed, wrote a troubled woman.
I dreamed that a big white horse kept following me wherever I went. I was afraid of him and pushed him away. I looked back to see if he was still following me, and he appeared to have become a man. I told him to go inside a barbershop and shave off his mane, which he did. When he came out, he looked just like a man, except that he had horse's hooves and face and followed me wherever I went. He came closer to me, and I woke up. I am a married woman of 35 with 2 children. I have been married for 14 years now, and I am sure my husband is faithful to me.
The unconscious sends all sorts of vapors, odd beings, terrors, and deluding images up into the mind, whether in dream, broad daylight, or insanity. For the human kingdom, beneath the floor of the comparatively neat little dwelling that we call our consciousness, goes down into unsuspected Aladdin caves. There, not only jewels, but also dangerous jinn abide. The inconvenient or resisted psychological powers that we have not thought or dared to integrate into our lives. And they may remain unsuspected. Or, on the other hand, some chance word, the smell of a landscape, the taste of a cup of tea, or the glance of an eye may touch a magic spring. And then dangerous messengers begin to appear in the brain. These are dangerous because they threaten the fabric of the security into which we have built ourselves and our family. But they are fiendishly fascinating, too, for they carry keys that open the whole realm of the desired and feared adventure of the discovery of the self. Destruction of the world that we have built and in which we live, and of ourselves within it. But then a wonderful reconstruction of the bolder, cleaner, more spacious, and fully human life. That is the lure, the promise and terror of these disturbing night visitants from the mythological realm that we carry within. Psychoanalysis, the modern science of reading dreams, has taught us to take heed of these unsubstantial images. Also, it has found a way to let them do their work. The dangerous crises of self-development are permitted to come to pass under the protecting eye of an experienced initiate in the lore and language of dreams, who then enacts the role and character of the ancient mystagogue, or guide of souls, the initiating medicine man of the primitive forest sanctuaries of trial and initiation. The doctor is the modern master of the mythological realm, the knower of all the secret ways and words of potency. His role is precisely that of the wise old man of the myths and fairy tales, whose words assist the hero through the trials and terrors of the weird adventure. He is the one who appears and points to the magic shining sword that will kill the dragon terror, tells of the waiting bride and the castle of many treasures, applies healing balm to the almost fatal wounds, and finally dismisses the conqueror back into the world of normal life, following the great adventure into the enchanted night. When we turn now with this image in mind, to consider the numerous strange rituals that have been reported from the primitive tribes and great civilizations of the past, it becomes apparent that the purpose and actual effect of these was to conduct people across those difficult thresholds of transformation that demand a change in the patterns not only of conscious, but also of unconscious life.
In such ceremonials as those of birth and burial, the significant effects are, of course, those experienced by the parents and relatives. All rites of passage are intended to touch not only the candidate, but also every member of his circle.
The so-called rites of passage, which occupy such a prominent place in the life of a primitive society, ceremonials of birth, naming, puberty, marriage, burial, etc., are distinguished by formal and usually very severe exercises of severance, whereby the mind is radically cut away from the attitudes, attachments, and life patterns of the stage being left behind. Then follows an interval of more or less extended retirement, during which are enacted rituals designed to introduce the life adventurer to the forms and proper feelings of his new estate, so that when, at last, the time has ripened for the return to the normal world, the initiate will be as good as reborn. Most amazing is the fact that a great number of the ritual trials and images correspond to those that appear automatically in dream the moment the psychoanalyzed patient begins to abandon his infantile fixations and to progress into the future. Among the Aborigines of Australia, for example, one of the principal features of the ordeal of initiation, by which the boy at puberty is cut away from the mother and inducted into the society and secret lore of the men, is the rite of circumcision.
When a little boy of the Murnjin tribe is about to be circumcised, he is told by his fathers and by the old men, "The great father snake smells your foreskin. He is calling for it." The boys believe this to be literally true and become extremely frightened. Usually, they take refuge with their mother, mother's mother, or some other favorite female relative, for they know that the men are organized to see that they are taken to the men's ground, where the great snake is bellowing. The women wail over the boys ceremonially. This is to keep the great snake from swallowing them.